We're about to wrap up 40 days that Moses spent with God up on Mount Sinai, getting more information that the people of Israel were going to need in order to live in the promised land as his people, as his special possession. I want to emphasize that because of what happens the day before God finishes up talking with Moses. So keep that in the back of your mind in just a moment. So we're in Exodus chapter number 31. We're going to start at verse number 12. And I'll remind you that one of the events that happened after God gave the Ten Commandments, which included the Sabbath command, was that somebody, the following Sabbath after that command was given, violated it. Apparently, intentionally, flagrantly, he went out collecting sticks in order to make a fire on the Sabbath day. That's what the passage told us in Numbers chapter 15. And so the people didn't know what to do about that. They took him to Moses, and Moses was not sure, so they basically locked him up somehow or confined him somewhere to wait until Moses could get clarification from God regarding that issue. So here we are at the end of the 40 days that Moses has been talking with God, and we get back to that topic. In fact, it's the final topic that God speaks to Moses about. So again, Exodus chapter 31, verse 12. He who is said to Moses, you are to speak to the people of Israel and say, above all, you shall keep my Sabbaths. And so this was probably with Moses saying, God, by the way, we've got somebody confined right now who violated the Sabbath day right out of the box. What are we supposed to do with him? And so God's response is, that's serious. Now, I'm going to tell you, I believe the guy was not accidentally or incidentally violating the Sabbath. I think his attitude was one of, I don't care. God's not the boss of me. He can't tell me what to do. And so that's really what's coming into play here. So above all, you shall keep my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you, that is the Israeli people, throughout your generations, that you may know that I, he who is, sanctify you. So it is one of the specialty markings of the Israeli people. They had gone for generations in Egypt as slaves without having any time off, without having any vacation. And so God gives them a national day of rest and even gives them a seventh year of national rest. And we know historically that that is how the Jewish people were known within the world. They were known as the people that took a full day off every single week, the Sabbath day. And you can even go to some of the laws that were put in place by the Roman government during the first century BC, and it's actually reaffirmed in the first century AD, that Jewish people's national day off was protected under Roman law. In fact, you could not force a Jewish person to come to court in the Roman system on Friday afternoon because they were preparing for their Sabbath day, and you could not violate that. And it's right there in black and white in the Roman law code. So the Sabbath day is very Jewish. Verse 14, you shall keep the Sabbath because it is holy for you. It's set aside for you. It's for your benefit. everyone who profanes it, and so profane here is the idea of opposite of making it holy, shall be put to death. So that's the answer to the question that Moses has brought to God. What am I supposed to do with the guy that intentionally blew up the Sabbath day? And God's response is, you have to execute him. It's serious. Whoever does any work on it, that soul or individual shall be cut off from among his people, which is a euphemism for execution. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, holy to who is. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall be put to death. Therefore, the people of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout their generations as a covenant forever. It is a sign, so here it is again, it is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel that in 6 days he who is made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. Now, I'm not going to go back and revisit the whole issue of whether or not non-Jews are required by Scripture to keep the Sabbath day, because I think I've made that pretty clear that it is not a requirement. You can scour the New Testament, and the only thing that you find is telling Judaizers they cannot force people to become Jewish, including circumcision and keeping the Sabbath, in order to be saved by Jesus. There's also passages where Paul in particular gets after Gentiles for allowing themselves to be bullied in that area. Now, having said that and reminded you of the New Testament teachings on that topic, that doesn't change the principle behind the Sabbath, which is every human being needs time off. You can't just work 7 days a week. You've got to take time off. And so make sure that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater when you go to the passages in the New Testament that say we're not required to keep the Sabbath. That does not mean you still don't need time off. So make sure you take time off. Now, before we leave this, I want to make a little comment about work. The Jewish people, over time, and we're talking more like the Pharisaical mindset toward the second and first centuries of the BC era, right before Jesus comes into the world, they really went overboard in trying to define work. And so by the time Jesus shows up, he has to deal with Pharisees hating on him and hating on his apostles when they do things that are clearly not work. Jesus heals people. That was not work. And yet the Pharisees wanted him killed over that. His apostles, in a story that's told particularly in Matthew chapter 12, is the one I'm thinking about, they were just walking through the grain fields on a Sabbath day and reached out and snapped off the heads of grain for a quick snack. And so they snapped it off, rubbed the grain heads between their hands, and blew out the chaff. And the Pharisees had a cow about that, because they thought that they had harvested, that they had threshed, and that they had winnowed. And no, they hadn't done any of those things. They had done what is equivalent to us of opening a food package, you know, tearing it open so that you can get at the product on the inside. It was not work. And so Jesus has to fight, metaphorically speaking, with the Pharisees over the proper understanding of what work is. And one of the things that he said, and this is in the Matthew 12 passage, is that the Sabbath was made for humanity's sake, not the other way around. it was put in place to give man time off from working 7 days a week. And when it's all said and done, the Son of Man, and I don't think this is Jesus' title that's being talked about here in Matthew 12:8, but rather the generic title for humanity. Humanity is the Lord of the Sabbath. They're the ones that are supposed to benefit from having that time off. They shouldn't be enslaved to all these silly rules and regulations that do not actually touch on the idea of work. Well, we'll probably come back to this topic more than once over our journey through the scripture, but that is the last topic in this 40-day discussion between Moses and God up on Mount Sinai. In verse 18 of Exodus 31 says, He, meaning God, gave to Moses, when he had finished speaking with him on Mount Sinai, the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written with the finger of God. So the first edition of the Ten Commandments are written on two tablets. They're probably not terribly big. I don't picture them much bigger than a page of notebook paper. And they're written on both sides of each tablet. 10 words or 10 sayings that compose the bulk of Exodus chapter number 20. And it's all written in God's handwriting. Now, why do I mention that? Because over time, Hebrew lettering changes. That's common with all living languages. But what we found out is that in later manuscripts, later scrolls of the Word of God, they retained the letter style of the 15th century BC Hebrew lettering whenever they wrote the name of God in some of these manuscripts. And the reason they seem to have done that was to basically preserve God's autograph, if you will. Because in the Ten Commandments, God's divine name, He who is, Yahweh, is found several times. And they just simply kept that lettering style through time as God's signature. So I just find that kind of intriguing. If you ever have a chance to go and see the Dead Sea Scrolls, you might want to take note when you're looking at a passage that has the divine name in it to see that there is a little place where there's four letters that are clearly in a different letter style than all the other letters around it. And that is more than likely the divine name. Now, what happens to this first edition of God's autographed Ten Commandments is part of the next story. And for that, we have to fall back one day from the completion of God talking to Moses. Chapter 32 says, When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron, and they said to him, Up, get up, make us Elohim, that's the Hebrew word, it is plural in form, but it is used as if it were singular when God, He who is being referenced. And so what's happening here is that the, at least a representative sample of the Israeli people come to Aaron on the 30th day of the fourth month of this new Jewish year, this first year of the Exodus. That's the day before Moses finishes with God and returns from Mount Sinai. He's going to return on the first day of the fifth Jewish month. So the day before Moses is about to come back, that's when these guys decide that they've waited long enough. After all, they've got a new month coming up. And so they tell Aaron, you need to get up as our leader. You need to make an image of Elohim, of God, who is going to go before us, as in go before us to take us into the promised land. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. So they have given up on him. They've decided to declare him missing in action, and they want Aaron to finish the journey with them. But they also want God to go with them. And for their little polytheistic mindset, because remember, they've been in Egypt for 430 years, so they picked up a lot of bad pagan habits, like believing in multiple gods and believing in idols. So they want an idol representing Elohim, he who is, to lead them to the promised land as promised. Now, this would be the chance for Aaron to go, no, did you pay attention at all about 50 or so days ago when the voice of God said, you will have no other gods but me and you will not make images? Did you pay attention a bit? But that is not what he does. He would have been a hero if he had. But instead, he does this. Verse 2. So Aaron said to them, take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. Now I remind you again that when the Israelites left Egypt, at God's direction, they, quote, spoiled the Egyptians, end quote. They went to their neighbors. They went to the Egyptians living around them and said, give us things of value. You owe us. It was back pay, back wages for all those years of them being slaves. And so the Israelis, as I've said several times now, became instantly wealthy in their departure from Egypt. And so all of them have got gold and silver jewelry. And so they're wearing it. And so Aaron says, this is what I need. I need a whole bunch of gold to do this project. So have everybody donate at least one little gold ring from their personal possession, and I'll use all of that to make this representation of he who is. Verse 3. So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron, and he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. It is extremely important to understand from the passage here that Aaron is the one that decided what shape this image should take. It's not a miracle, which is what he's actually going to try to claim later with Moses. He intended to make this golden calf. Now, why? As we've already said, they have recently come out of 430 years in Egypt. And not very far from Goshen was the city of Memphis. Not our Memphis, Egypt Memphis, the original one. Memphis, patron god was Ptah. That's spelled P-T-A-H. And Ptah was supposed to be the creator god. He is the one that made everything else, according to the mythology of Memphis. And Ptah is represented on earth in the form of a special bull. A bull that has special markings when it's born. And these Apis bulls become objects of worship, and they are treated as gods in the flesh when they're alive, and then they're mummified. But it's not just that. The Egyptian people, particularly the ones around Memphis, would make images in the form of an Apis bull. Sometimes these bulls would just be a freestanding golden bull. Other times it would have like a solar disk between its horns to show that it was attached to, you know, the sun power. And so Aaron seems to be thinking in his head, well, it's the Creator God who brought us out of Egypt. If I'm going to represent him in physical form, I need to represent him as the Creator God of the Egyptians. Now, this is all bad. It's horrible. It shows a loophole of understanding, or at least manipulation, of the rules that they've just received. God said, don't have any other gods before me. Don't make images of gods and goddesses to bow down and worship them. And somehow, Aaron and others thought, well, you know what? He didn't say we shouldn't make something to represent him. And so that's what he does. Now, a lot of people are saying that he was just engaging in outright idolatry when he did this. But I want you to listen to his own words that are coming up here. It says this, verse number 4 continues. They said first to the Israelis who commissioned him to do this, these are your gods. Now that's the grammar, because the word is plural. Or, this is your Elohim, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. So it is clear that Aaron and these people that Aaron is working with are trying to engage in what's called syncretism, the merging together of different religious concepts. So he wants these people to look at this golden calf as a representation of he who is, the God that brought them up out of the land of Egypt. And now they will carry, or at least that was their intention, this image in front of them or with them all the way to the promised land. That would have been their intention. And it's going to kick off with a big ceremony. Verse 5, when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. So Aaron is acting as a priest. He's acting as a leader, a religious leader. And he makes an altar to be used in worship. And then Aaron made this proclamation. He said, tomorrow shall be a feast to he who is. That verse makes it exceptionally clear. They are going to present this as the worship of the true and living God. And they are flat out wrong in doing so. And that will become clear in how God and then Moses react to this. Now, the tomorrow that he's talking about is the first day of the fifth month. And I think that that chronologically makes good sense, because they already understand that the first day of each new month is going to be a special day. So they're going to make it a big worship day for God as a golden calf. Now, before we move on, I want you to keep this all in mind later when we get to Jeroboam of northern Israel making two golden calves, which he will then declare represent Yahweh, represent he who is to the people of northern Israel when they break away from the Davidic kingdom of Judah and also divorce themselves from worship in the temple at Jerusalem. It was done for political reasons, but it is sheathed in religiosity because Jeroboam, who had recently come back from time spent in Egypt, wanted to represent Yahweh to the people of northern Israel in a physical form of a calf or a bull. All right, back to our Exodus text. It says, verse 6, they rose up early the next morning. They offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. So they're going through a worship ceremony, supposedly to God. And then the people sat down to eat and drink. That's fairly normal when you worship in the context of the ancient world. But then it says they also rose up to play. The word play here is also a euphemism to fool around sexually. And we know that in many pagan religions, sexual activity goes hand in hand with worship of that god or goddess. That there is some sort of concept that you're coming into connection with the divine through the sexual act with somebody who represents that divine being. So it seems as if these guys are just going total pagan on this golden calf incident. And that is where we want to set the stage for our session tomorrow. Verse 7, he who is said to Moses, it's early morning on the first day of the fifth month, go down, for your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They've made for themselves a golden calf, and they've worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. So God says to Moses, you need to go down and bring these people to heel, because they are totally blowing off everything that I gave to them in the Ten Commandments.